Blog Talk Radio. Okay, folks, it looks like we had some technical difficulties with our songboard, but hooray to the United States Army and to the Air Force, Marine Corps, the Navy, and now the Space Force and the Coast Guard. Welcome to Continue Mission. I'm your host, James McCormick, and tonight we have a really good show lined up for you. We are going to talk about a very important topic. And it really is about the working poor, you know, and, you know, people like to make fun of the poor folks of the world and you know, say, well, they're just poor because they're lazy. And that's just not true. There are a lot of people that work one and two jobs and they are still broke, folks. And it's not because of bad decisions. It's because of a bad economy or it's because of a bad situation that they're in. You know, they may or may not have gotten themselves into there. But the truth of the matter is that they didn't in most cases. But ultimately, if people, especially those people that claim that they have faith, claim that they are supposed to follow a pathway of, you know, whether it be a Judeo-Christian or Islamic religion or anything, you know, I'm telling you, there is mentions of the poor and our responsibility, you know, to the poor. It's just the way it is, folks. So we're going to talk about that. We're also going to have a special guest on here tonight, and that's Dr. Crystal Cook. And let me tell you, I met Crystal a few years ago whenever we were talking about the Veterans and Warriors to Agriculture program. And, you know, that was a great program. It really took off. There were a lot of folks that were trained in farming, and some of them are still doing it. Unfortunately, you know, it just kind of has fell to the wayside, or, you know, no one's taken up the mantle to keep really pushing that program forward. And I hope somebody does. I really do, because it was a great program. You got to keep the politics out of it. I'm just going to tell you right now, politics destroys everything. When you put it under the control of a politician who may want to use it to, you know, to get elected, but they don't really love and care and try to nurture the program, then it'll never go anywhere. Crystal Cook's going to talk a little bit of what she's doing in Appalachia. And so I'm not going to steal any of her thunder, but also got Rich Kilblaine on here, and I've got Father Michael Patel on here. Hey, Father Mike, Rich, how's it going this evening?
Very well, thank you.
Okay, how was your week this week?
Busy, giving exams. I got two to give tomorrow. I had a award ceremony with the ROTC at William & Mary. Very busy time for church as well, but it's good.
How about you, Rich? How was your week?
Hey, I was just inducted into, I'm a distinguished member of the regiment, the Transportation Corps Regiment. We had the award ceremony today, so they have recognized my 18 years of contribution to the Corps. Now, reality is the two guys that submitted my packet, I had Sergeant Major Perry was one, and Mike Aguilar was the other. I think you know those two guys. I have known them since they were in 6th Trans Battalion, back when they came back from Iraq and OF1. So I went up to them and I said, yeah, this is beginning. This is kind of a 6th Trans Battalion cabal. All right. So anyway, that's what happened today.
Man, you know, congratulations. That's pretty good, man. That's pretty good. And, you know, for those of you that don't know, Rich was the U.S. Army Transportation Corps historian, command historian. And, you know, that's how we met, you know, and that was many, many years ago, back in 2004.
I'll add something to that. I mean, when I wore the uniform, I was infantry and special forces, and I was an officer for 11 years. And it was funny because we were having a regimental induction, remember what we called it, induction ceremony or board. And I was sitting on the panel, and so I was in my suit one of the few times I wore it. And I had my airborne tie tack on, and Sergeant Major Perry, who was at that time the regimental sergeant major, saw that. He's like, grabbed me and dragged me over. We were in the museum, dragged me over to the gift shop. And he goes, take that tie tack off and buy one of these and put it on. You know, the spearhead of logistics, he said, you're one of us now. And I looked at him like, yeah, I've been a transporter for 11 years now. I've been a transporter longer than I was infantry or special force. So I guess you're right. So yeah, you cut me, and I bleed brick red. Okay. For all transporters out there, they know what I'm talking about. That's our branch colors.
And there you go.
But all three of us are transporters, because when I met Father Michael, he was the Transportation Corps School, Transportation School chaplain. And James, of course, Branch Transportation Corps.
Mm-hmm.
After his, he served in the Transportation Corps when he was in Iraq, and then he branched mm-hmm. when he came back.
Yep, yep. And here we are today. So, spearhead of logistics.
Still moving along.
Still moving along. Not as fast, not as agile, but still moving.
Yep.
That's the main thing. So the topic tonight is going to be talking about the poor and the destitute. And I'd like to start this off. And Rich, I know you have a message that you want to put out towards the end of the show. So make sure you remind me of that, you know, so we don't run out of time. Father Michael, let's talk a little bit about the poor. I know you brought this subject up, and I don't say that word, the poor, to be derogatory. It's just the reality. You sent us some pretty interesting statistics. Would you mind going over some of those right now?
What I found that was fascinating from my perspective was that there are 2,000 verses in Scripture that pertain to the poor. So it must be pretty important that we pay attention to that. Years ago, and I tried to figure it out, it's probably around 48 years ago, I was serving as assistant pastor in a church, and somebody came to ask me for money. And I had just read this verse, and of course, sometimes we're over spiritual. If I don't give you Jesus, I've given you nothing. And so let me read the verse, and let me tell you the end of the story real quick. It's in Proverbs 21, verse 13. He who shuts his ear to the cry of the poor will also cry himself and not be answered. And so I was really convicted by that. About a year later, I went to take my first church in New London, Connecticut, and I stopped in that church. They wanted to send me off. And here was that lady in church, you know, dressed up, and she had a check for me from the amount that I'd given to her. She wasn't looking for a handout. She was looking for a hand up. And sometimes, as you stated earlier, James, we have such an attitude. You know, James says, you know, it's great to say, you know, be filled, be warmed, and don't do anything about it. You know, someone like Franklin Graham, Mother Teresa, you know, will go into a country and there's no litmus test. They'll give clean water and a blanket in Jesus' name, but they don't ask you if you're a Christian. They see that you have a need and you're in great poverty. And so I just think that we have to face the fact that we have a moral obligation. We can't leave everything to the government, just like we've seen with the homeless veterans. And there's just a lot to be said. I was looking at the scripture in Acts chapter 4, and some of the believers sold some of their extra land, and they brought the proceeds to the apostles' feet so that they could boast that there was not a needy one among them. Now, this is voluntary. This is not socialism. They had extra houses. They didn't sell the houses or lands they were living in or on. But I just want us to look at the fact that sometimes we're, you know, fat cats, and I grew up poor in the projects in Newark, New Jersey. I know what it's like to weigh the same amount and be embarrassed in school when we had to tell what we ate for breakfast and I had to lie. And so I would like us to, you know, open some sensitivity. I have shared before that on my way to Vietnam, stopped in the Philippines. I thought I was poor in Newark, New Jersey in the projects until I saw real poverty in the Philippines. They were living in cardboard houses and jumping into the sewer, you know, throw dime, Joe, throw dime, you know, just so they could survive. So when we look at the world stage, Rich and I had a wonderful talk today. Most of the world looks at us Americans as wealthy, even those who live below the poverty line. Yet, as you so astutely stated, I see people walking all the time with their Wendy's uniforms or whatever. They're on their feet at Walmart. I see older people. There's truly the working poor. And so I'm just wondering, you know, how we're supposed to approach that. You know, we always talk about teaching someone how to fish, but until they learn how to fish, we may need to give them some fish. We need to give a hand up, not a hand out. I told Rich an interesting story. It was in my Harvard magazine, where a woman was trying to raise a crop in her country, and the insects were destroying the crop. And he sent her a little packet of insecticide. It cost him $75, and it wasn't any religious thing. It just he had the know-how. And not only did she have a bumper crop, but she was able to then sell to her neighbors. And so we're just talking about empowering people. I'm so grateful my grandparents came from Italy. Both my parents were born here. But when I look at how the young people are struggling just to get a job, and I look at the opportunities that I've had in this country, you know, when I went, they showed me an Italian flag. I couldn't wear that. Oh, an Italian flag and an American flag, perhaps. But as an American, I've been afforded such opportunities. I'm the first one to graduate college in my family, first one to receive a PhD and other degrees. So we have great resources here, and we just have to show people, just like you did, James, last week about the veterans benefits. We just have to show people, you know, how they can access certain things. Now, some people have nothing but sweat equity, and that's okay. My grandparents were farmers in Italy. My grandfather worked as a garbage man in Lower Manhattan. Then he worked in a factory, and he owned his own home. It was like a 2-3 family home. And so, you know, we just want to look at, and not in a way that we think we're superior to them, but they maybe haven't had the same opportunities. And sometimes, you know, I was telling Rich today, my wife was working, even though she's a teacher, as a hostess in a restaurant. And she called me one night and she said, one of the cooks had a fire in his home and he has nothing. And so I want you to put together some clothing. I said, oh, I'll get around to it. She said, no, no, you need to do it now. He had a house fire. It had nothing to do with what he did or what he did not do. And so I had so many extra clothes. I filled this big, you know, black garbage bag and brought it there immediately. And that's all I'm saying, that we're sensitive that there are people that have had high-paying jobs and then something went wrong. They had a divorce. It cost them a lot of money or some other bad break. Now, you know, there are people that are slothful and lazy and all that kind of thing, but it's not for us to judge. I always say that it's more honorable to beg than to steal. And there are people even around our wealthy city of Williamsburg, and you know, we just have to open our hearts to people, and you know, and just understand. Like I said, I didn't read this in a book. We were very poor, and of course my father abused alcohol. He was a 100% disabled vet, but he used all the grocery money on drinking and would throw us out in the middle of the night walking in a bad neighborhood. But not being able to eat, we were malnourished. And so I understand what it is. And mm-hmm. you know, my mom, she worked. She was there keeping us together. You know, he'd go to where she worked and embarrass her, and she'd get fired. And, you know, so, you know, it's one thing to talk about it theoretically, but I've been there, and so there's a sensitivity that I just want to make us aware of. And also the mandate from Scripture.
Right. Right. Well, we're glad that you're on here giving us that, you know, that perspective. And I want to talk a little bit about our guest before we bring her on. And if you don't mind, I'm going to read this real quickly. Originally from Mercer County, West Virginia, and with roots in McDowell County, West Virginia, Crystal finished her PhD in science and technology studies in examining the potential for land-based industry growth in Southwest Virginia. So she got her PhD in science and technology in 2017 at Virginia Tech. Cool. And basically, as part of her research, she examined the stakeholders and funding mechanisms that make an economic sector happen and continue to exist. As her case study, she did a deep dive of the Pocahontas coal field that includes counties in West Virginia and Virginia. Along with this, in 2017, with four others, she co-founded the McDowell County, West Virginia Nonprofit Economic Development Greater East Edge, which is building the 21st century economy where food is foundational, land is conserved, and people are valued. That's so wonderful. Edge has a range of 21st century economic projects ranging from a demonstration farm for mountain farming and products to a community grocery. With her husband, Edward, she has also been farming in the foothills of North Carolina since 2011. And I tell you, that's really, really cool because Crystal, I've met Crystal, and I can tell you that, you know, she's very focused. And we actually, at one point in time, we attended the same high school together. I don't think at the same time because, but I think that she'll remind me of that, that it was Winfield High School. So anyways, I think that that having Crystal on here is going to really, really be a great opportunity for our show, and to show that you know what, not only is she helping, you know, the poor people in the area, but she's helping to bring economic development in an area where none exists. None exists.
Right.
If you didn't have coal, if you weren't doing coal mining, you know, I like that show, Coal Miner's Daughter, you know, when the old guy says,
yeah,
coal mine, moonshine, or moving on down the line, you know. But obviously they don't – you wish that all they did was moonshine. Now you're looking at, you know, the coal mine, meth labs, or heroin. And, you know, and that's just the reality of it all. So Crystal's trying to take a bite out of that. And so we're going to bring Dr. Cook on here. Dr. Crystal Cook, welcome to Continue Mission. Appreciate you staying on here with us. I know that we had a little glitch. We love to play our music, and I don't know what happened. It just kind of stopped. So welcome to the show.
I appreciate the time. Great. It's great to be here. It was a horror. I had to take a disco nap in order to be on anything for 10 to 12 tonight, even on Fridays. So, golly, y'all, we got to pick an earlier time in the day, right? It's actually fine because everyone else is quiet. It's a good time. Everybody's quiet. I need to attend to. So I'm enjoying the show already, and I look forward to getting to know these new gentlemen more. And yes, James, it was Winfield High School. I believe you're older than I am, so I went there. I graduated a little after you.
Yeah, I am obviously older than she is. So yes, absolutely.
Very much so.
Yeah, we won't go there. I do shame in turning mid-century this year. So, you know, with that comes perspective, which we all could use a little more of these days.
So, you know, you're kind of listening to, you know, Father Pacella's
sure.
view on the poor. And obviously, you know, being a minister and a, you know, obviously someone that found his entire foundation is based on faith. People of faith have an obligation to the poor.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, what moved you, Crystal, to do what you're doing? Because I've seen some of the work you're doing. I follow you on Facebook. I know, you know, we have mutual friends and, you know, unfortunately, you know, Sylvester was tragically killed. And, but, you know, we have a lot of mutual friends, and I love what you're doing, and you've never quit. You've just never quit. So what drove you?
I was thinking about this earlier today. It was funny. I didn't know if I would be asked this question, and we're leading with this question. So, you know, I grew up, you know, I cut my teeth in southern West Virginia, and my parents were always very civically minded. you know, they weren't necessarily at the forefront of civics in southern West Virginia, but that was always a topic. The news was always discussed. Even as a young child, I was very aware of the Vietnam War, and politics were always discussed in our household. And my mother was actually part of the local women's club that did a lot of civics work, and so I was taking, you know, as a much younger child from much older sisters, and I was taken along to all of those civic activities. And also, you know, through church, that and the civic activities instilled in me, and the father talked about a moral obligation. I've always felt a moral obligation to be of service. And so, of course, I'm much younger than President Kennedy, but the idea of, you know, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. I mean, that is always, you know, in that. I mean, I can't compare it to people who have, you know, given all or, you know, who've served in the military, but my motto for my life has always been to be of service. And when I went to college, out of West Virginia, and I thought I wanted to be a broadcast journalist. My goal had been to help bridge peoples during the Cold War, and I had learned German and Russian, and I thought, well, I'm going to go do that. And as I went off to do that, the wall fell, and the whole game changed. And so that was, you know, the wall was down, and the borders were open, and so, you know, the concept of sort of bridging peoples wasn't exactly the same. I ended up in some nonprofit work there, and I've been either nonprofit or education in some way ever since. I was torn that I couldn't do more. And so many years later, I had the opportunity to talk briefly with the late Phil Haynes of the Haynes, you know, Cotton folks. He's also the benefactor of Winston-Salem School of the Arts, and he and his wife started Grayson Meats. You might be familiar with them down in Southwest Virginia. In any case, he said to me, I was, you know, kind of seeking in the early 2000s my next step, and I'd had this concept of a school down in southern West Virginia. And he said, of course, you know, you don't ask people who aren't doing anything to do something. You ask people who are already doing something to do more.
Right.
That's the truth.
Stuck with me, and that's stuck with me ever since. And so, you know, I found a group of people that somehow we managed to squeeze in those extra hours in the day somewhere to keep doing more. I've been very fortunate to work with the folks that I'm working with in southern West Virginia. And frankly, again, back to the moral obligation, I was thinking about the word morality again today. And filling up, you know, we have a nonprofit. We didn't mean to start a nonprofit, but we were encouraged to start it, so we did. And, you know, I know we've got a couple hours here, another guest, but, you know, a long story to how we finally got structured and what we're finally doing. And so it took, you know, 5 or 6 years to really sort ourselves out. But, you know, here we are, all volunteer. We've been all volunteer until, hopefully some people will become professionalized in it here in 2022. But we've been all volunteer for the last 5 years. And so in the last several weeks, I'm filling out, you know, grant applications yet again. And, you know, we've written all this text, and I'm kind of reviewing the text again. And one thing stood out to me, and it was the sentence, and there was a citation there, that McDowell County, West Virginia, and I'll give a little background on McDowell County once I give the statistic, was, I think in 2018 or maybe 17, by some independent review board, voted the worst place to live in America. And before I get into how we ended up there, because I think you showed some of that at the beginning of your show about, you know, people aren't often intentionally poor, right?
Right.
Like, great choice for today. I want to go do this.
Right.
I thought, well, you know, don't we have a moral obligation here? I mean, yes, I've been involved in McDowell, and I've been following McDowell my whole life. When I was a child, but I spent a lot of time in McDowell County. My maternal grandmother was born there when it was just a coal camp. My father worked one summer underground with working a mule in my uncle's pick mine. He'd been a miner. My grandfather had been a miner in McDowell. And, you know, at one time there were 98,000 people who lived there. It was the biggest city, well, the biggest place, not city, but the biggest sort of most populated municipality along the 36th parallel after you leave Norfolk, Virginia. If you drive 10 hours out of Norfolk going towards Bowling Green, Kentucky, McDowell County was the most populated place. Now it's Danville, Virginia, but McDowell County was in the 50s, the most populated. And now it's at about 19,000 and still sitting on about, you know, 100,000 people worth of infrastructure. And I thought to myself, where is the moral outrage, really? You know, I've tried to induce some moral outrage at Virginia Tech, but I've got long stories there. You know, this place, the place that's voted one of the worst places in America is an hour from you, 1 hour from you, you know, at an R1 wealthy research university. Yes, you're in a different state, but still, you know, don't we have, you know, a moral, you know, beyond the odd obligation that the core group of us have continued to feel for McDowell County, you know, the, you know, I know you know veteran Jason Tart, and so, you know, we're Generation X, and I've met some other Generation X folks, and I think you're also Generation X, doing some interesting stuff in West Virginia, and, you know, I've commented, obviously, we're crazy because we continue to do this stuff when people tell us they're, you know, pave it over. I mean, I've literally heard that from McDowell. Why don't you just fill it all in with water? You know, someone said that to me, you know, 10 years ago. And, you know, so I continue to feel a moral imperative. I mean, and although I've lived in New York City and I've lived in Los Angeles and abroad, I kind of feel for some reason that if we can make it there, if we can make it happen in McDowell, and we can make it happen anywhere. So I'll stop there. Again, you know, I've got a captive audience here and I could talk for 2 weeks straight about all this. But I will say this, you know, often people don't realize the resources that they have, and resources are not pointed out to them, and I have a lot to say about that in the rural space of the United States. That, you know, when I examined the coal field there, one of the things I wanted to see was, how did this get started? I mean, you know, we take for granted that somehow coal has magically always been there. Like, the people mine coal there because there's coal there. Like, if there had been coal in Charlotte, they would have mined it there. It's not like they said, oh, let's go put a coal mine, a coal field here. You know, this has happened to be where it was, and it was something before. And it will be something after. Nothing, you know, is static. Nothing remains the same. And there are lots of resources there that haven't been, you know, made use of that could be made use of. There's just no investment in them. So I'll stop there. I know I said a lot.
Well, no, I'm glad that you did go into that, Crystal, because, you know, here's the deal. We do have a moral obligation, you know, to humanity. We really do. And, you know, I made a career for 22 years out of crushing as much of that as I could, you know, under the auspice of warfare. And if I wasn't crushing it, you know, we were training to crush it. And it was, you know, coming out of that experience that drove me personally, you know, to take a pathway that is a more humane, more of a, you know, an effort to help people succeed. You know, I think that the normal people, now there's a lot of abnormal, you know, Zool type characters out there that, you know, they really, you know, they get off on people suffering, you know, but
right.
The normal people, you know, the people that have a conscience, the people that have, even a basic education, generally like to see people succeed. And
yeah, most
because
people
want
to go
understand.
Home to their families. They want to spend time with their families. They want to do their thing. They just want to be left alone and have some peace. They want to work their jobs. They want to go home. You know, some people don't want to, you know, mess with others and, you know, those people, you know, the regular folks, you know, that get up and do whatever grind it is every day and come home and, you know, try to move themselves and their kids and their families forward in some way.
Yeah. And so McDowell County, you know, obviously we both, you know, spent some time there and it is a, you know, it is a sad story. It really is. It's a sad story. It's a heartbreaking story. But there are people that are living there that don't see their home as the worst place in America to live.
No.
You know, they see it as their home and they want to improve it. So tell me a little bit about, I have an unfair advantage because, you know, I know a little bit about what you're doing, but the 130,000 listeners out there, they really don't know exactly what you are doing.
Sure.
When you talk about developing, so you're essentially going into an area that has basically nothing. I mean, because some of the areas that I've seen you go into, they really, there's nothing there. So what are some of the things that you look for when you go to consider creating an economy? So that's what you're doing. You're creating an economic opportunity. So what's process?
Let me outline a few things. So what I learned, so I did a deep dive on the Pocahontas coal field, and you'll see why I'm going back to history to bring it to today. And I also worked for a coal energy research group at Virginia Tech. So I was lucky to be able to take this through line from the 19th century to the 21st century. You know, but in short, so imagine, if you will, whatever it is, you know, where you live, whatever the main industry is, and go back to a time when that wasn't there. That's not that long ago, right? So, you know, America, you know, most of us, if it wasn't, I mean, for me, it was my parents. You know, I grew up rural, and my mother agrarian as a, you know, a sharecropper. But for most of us, it might have been, you know, the good father that I mentioned, his, you know, grandparents or great-grandparents, I think, in Italy. You know, a couple generations back, most of us of European descent, which I am, you know, we were agrarian farmers, you know, and all of that changed during the Industrial Revolution. So whatever big sector is the big sector near you, somebody put that together. I mean, so one of the most misleading concepts of the last 50 years is somehow there's this thing called the economy. And this is where my mentors at Virginia Tech were excellent in science and technology studies. What they specialize in this field is kind of taking whatever it is that's scientific or technical and breaking it apart and kind of showing how it was created, whether it's biology, economics, genetics, whatever it is, and showing that sort of the human creation behind it. And no, there's not an economy. There's no invisible hand. We create the economy. People create the economy. And the economic sectors near your work created. You know, whether it's folks who, you know, propagate that on the right or people on the left who use terms like capital moves. I'm like, no, it's not capital. People move. You know, they're actual people who create this. It's not just like money floating around in the air. And how did they do it? You can find the real people who did that. And that's what I did with the Pocahontas coal field. And what was interesting to me is, you know, a couple things to say. You know, some folks like to beat up on coal as, you know, that the reason, for example, McDowell County is so poor is that, you know, the coal mechanized in the 1950s. And going back and doing research, it was interesting to me that the 1960s, one of the biggest fears that Americans had was that their jobs would be automated away. And that's not a popular discussion now. It's not like something that you see in the news every day, but it was apparently in the 1960s and something that most Americans were very aware of, and with good reason, because that's what exactly happened in the coal fields. You know, they were mechanized, and they just didn't need the workers. And it's not like coal sought out to do that. All corporations do that. I mean, corporations, large corporations, are not about hiring people. I mean, they're going to do their best. You know, people get sick, people unionize, people don't show up. You know, people, you got to, you know, they want all kinds of crazy things, like, you know, off when their children, when they have their children, right? So corporations can get out of hiring people. They do. So the coal industry is no exception to that. And you know, that's one of my contentions I make with renewables as well. It's like, that's going to be true of renewable industries. Not like, you know, you're going to, the tremendous labor in all of this, whether we're setting up a coal sector or renewables, is in setup. Right, that's where all the labor comes. Then after that, the corporations are trying to figure out, you know, as quickly as possible how not to hire people. But in any case, there was one guy. His name was Jedediah Hotchkiss. I found the guy. He had been Stonewall Jackson's cartographer from New York State, but lived in Stanton, Virginia. And so he started lobbying somebody else. I forget what the other guy's name was. But before the Civil War, about 20 years before the Civil War, the Kanawha coal fields, the Central West Virginia coal fields opened up. There were coal fields in the Richmond Basin near Richmond, Virginia. And there was already a movement afoot there, you know, in Virginia that, you know, we think we've got coal. You know, I think we could do something, you know, with this coal. But they couldn't get anybody, any of the plantation owners and the folks in Congress in Virginia interested in funding the science and research that you needed to actually reveal the potential. And they lobbied for 20 years before the Civil War came. They really wanted to see Virginia kind of move towards the more industrial north. They'd seen what happened in Pennsylvania, and then the war happened, and that all, you know, fell flat. And so you have Jedediah Hotchkiss take up the mantle of this, and he lobbied for this for 40 years. So that's another one of the issues is, you know, I see all kinds of economic development folks, you know, around the region, and I see this agency do that and this program do that. But, you know, it took them 40 years of lobbying to get the coal industry opened up, the, you know, sector interest and the science interest, and to convince politicians and people with, you know, holding the purse strings to invest there. And they first had to convince people to bring in a railroad. So, you know, our region people might famously also know about the Hatfields and McCoys. So their big fight was about timber. Well, they could fight about timber once a railroad came in because there was all this old timber there. And after the railroad came in, then they could begin to exploit coal. So it was this one guy who did it. And so he died off in the 1880s before his dream was really realized, that he saw a moral obligation to take what was then called the two Virginias forward out of a plantation-based economy, to align them with the industrial north, what he saw was the future economy, right? So he was very forward-thinking, thinking like, this is where the economy is going. And he was right for that time. But he was driven by a moral obligation. And, you know, I don't know if, you know, many people have the conversation we're having earlier, you know, about a moral obligation for, you know, creating an economic sector, and, you know, much less, you know, we talk about helping people, but, you know, how do you kind of step back and say, well, what would the ultimate help be? And so our contention has been that the sector was created in southern West Virginia, and, you know, and it was a 19th century vision, but we know the fallout now from having that singular vision of an industrialized, you know, area, and with no sunset plan. It was supposed to, you know, continue forever, and people were supposed to be employed forever, and so on and so forth. And it worked pretty well until it didn't anymore. I mean, it made, you know, I'm sitting here today with a PhD because my grandfather had been a coal miner and was able, you know, most people who went to the coal mines were landless, right? They took landless folks from all around the world, and you know, he was able, from working in the mines or also working in shipbuilding during the war, you know, World War II, to eventually buy 200 acres. And, you know, that went over to my dad, and that turned over to, you know, business to my dad, so he didn't have to work in the mines. And my dad couldn't go to college, and here I am, you know, a couple generations later. So, you know, I owe great debt to the people who worked underground and did that difficult and terrifying often work. But, you know, that's the old economy. And so the thing that also struck me was how much this guy advocated for Europe. I think the good father is at William and Mary, right? You mentioned William and Mary?
Yes.
Yeah, so the universities in the region. This was before, you know, when science was just getting developed. Like, there wasn't really a geology department, right? People, this guy was a self-taught cartographer and a self-taught geologist. You had all kinds of people who were being self-taught in geology. There was no place to study geology. You had the University of Virginia. You had Washington and Lee. I think also maybe William and Mary. But you know, you had these prestigious universities doing geological work. So what this guy Jedediah did was he put together these scientific journals, you know, highlighting the best in science and the best in technology. And he, you know, continued to lobby the state of Virginia and the state of West Virginia to hire some professional geologists to go down and do the geology. And, you know, if you're unaware, you know, each coal mine to this day has a staff geologist. You know, each piece of land, you know, walk outside, you can see each piece of land is different. And, you know, you have to have somebody with scientific knowledge and technical knowledge to understand how to approach wherever you are. And this is true of the coal fields. And so he really based his advocacy on science and technology and research. And that's what he finally used to convince investors. And the principal investors became the federal government, right, the states of West Virginia, and the House of Morgan, as in J.P. Morgan, British, right? And the states put up about $10 million, but J.P. Morgan, if I recall correctly, put up $30 million. And I was on another podcast earlier this year, we were talking about this with the bank, and he found some formula to say that in 1880s money, that was a $1 billion investment for one coal field. And that's what it takes. So that's what it takes. So that's what I understood, like, that's what it takes. And regardless of what people think of, you know, two administrations ago, I had a good fortune when I started my PhD. I started it actually at Stony Brook in New York in energy policy. And we got to go to an energy conference. I was sitting there listening to the head of the UN's energy policy saying he thought, you know, the United States would never go towards, you know, renewables ever. And, you know, I read the energy policy that came out by, you know, from Obama at that point. That was like 2010, I think. It's been off like a couple of years. Well, anyway, within a year, it was a $200 million federal investment. And that's still small potatoes when you talk about economic sector investment.
Oh, yeah,
however,
yeah.
That signaled to private industry that the federal government is going to step up. And to this day, what creates the energy sector, whether it's natural gas, whether it's renewables, whether it's coal, it doesn't matter, is science and technology, the research. And where is that research done? Universities, principally. Why? How is it done? Through federal granting. And that's how it's continued to be maintained. So, you know, here I am. You know, I was a National Science Foundation scholar. I'm at Virginia Tech. I also was working in, you know, this energy center. And I thought, well, you know, I found some issues, and I thought maybe the university might assist me with, you know, helping to propose to some federal agencies that there's more research devoted to some things. So I go to, like, the president's office, and I'm sitting there with the research, you know, department from Virginia Tech, like the people out of the president's office. I'm explaining this to them, and they just stare at me blankly. And at the end of our conversation, they ask if there are any federal RFPs for these. And I said, well, no, that's kind of the point of our conversation, that we need to make them aware of this. And the gentleman literally said to me, well, if there are no federal RFPs, then certainly this is not important.
Crystal, I'm very impacted by your continual reference, even James's, you know, to the moral obligation. And something I've often talked about is the proper moral outrage. It's so interesting to hear all that you're saying. And I remember I was probably, you know, under 10, but that whole mindset of what you said, President Kennedy's quote, you know, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. When I went in the military in 1971, I'm a Vietnam vet, you know, we went in the service. And I really appreciate you talking about the fact that was your motivation. There's so many beautiful things here, and I appreciate so much learning, you know, from the history and everything else, but just references about helping other people and conscience, so many things that have been raised, I think, are the moral aspects, not even so much, you know, we talked earlier about sweat equity, but you're talking about, you know, making the economy or creating an economy. And these are just wonderful concepts, and I wish you'd continue to elaborate. They're very educational. Thank you.
Well, sure. I'm glad to. But so last but not least, you know, so I'm in front of these research, you know, the people who guide research, Virginia Tech's direction, and they basically tell me that if the federal government isn't already interested in it, then they have no interest, which then makes me understand that they chase the federal dollars, right? So if the federal government isn't already indicating that something is of interest, they're not going to be of interest, which means that the science and technology that we need to guide us is not going to be or taken seriously. And you know, to wrap up and give other people a chance to talk. So what I, you know, then realized was, well, it's, you know, back to the moral obligation, it's up to us. You know, we often discuss, my husband and I, you know, the cavalry, nor cavalry necessary, is coming. You know, we, in this post-industrial economy or situation in McDowell County, West Virginia, where all of the costs of doing business were externalized. That means that, you know, there was no – so, you know, not everybody does it this way, right? Not everybody who creates an economic sector anticipates that it will last forever. In other countries such as Sweden and Japan, if, let's say, like what's going on now in Oklahoma or you know, North Dakota, if you want to propose – or even, you know, northern West Virginia, natural gas or oil development, you want to propose tremendous sector investment – their question is, what's your sunset plan? You know, when does it mean when it ends? What are you going to do with everybody? You know, you can't just build all these schools and you know, do all this stuff, you know, what are you going to do when you don't need the people anymore? So, you know, in Japan and Sweden, they make the industry set aside a fund. And we do stuff for education, but it's not really, you know, really the exact same thing. It's like, okay, you want to do all this, that's great, but who's going to clean it up? And who's going to, you know, move people to something else when whatever it is that you're pretending is going to last forever tanks or, you know, doesn't need people in particular. And so that's the legacy of McDowell County. We are in the situation we're in because there was no sunset plan. Nobody felt a moral obligation really to do much of anything for a long time. And you know, back to James' point about politics, it didn't matter what stripe you wore. We wore one stripe for a long time in West Virginia and nothing changed. And people, you know, flipped to a different stripe. And, you know, it's debatable whether, you know, there's been much shift. However, what has remained constant is that we're, for the most part, the folks in McDowell County, and, you know, in similar situations, we're not unusual, whether it's in the Delta or Indian Country, or, you know, I've lived a lot in the former Soviet Union. You're out in this rural area where there was resource extraction, or, you know, you're left holding the bag of whatever's next. And the difference is, though, James said that, you know, I've been these places where there's nothing. The truth is that there's not nothing. Is that it's actually a relatively simple question is, if it had not been coal, what would have been developed here?
Mm-hmm.
And you can ask that wherever you are, you know, whether you're in Hickory, North Carolina, and it's, you know, I know there's a, you know, the textile industry, or if it's, you know, what was here before or what could be here again. And frankly, you know, in rural areas, it's mostly going to be natural resource tied. You know, economic developers, and I've talked to plenty of them, whether it's in, you know, universities or at city level or county level, most of them have some fantasy that they're going to attract in whoever it is from wherever it is, because now you can be anywhere because of broadband and the internet. And my contention back to them is that is correct. You can be anywhere. You can be in Malibu. So why in God's name would they need to come to McDowell County when you sit in Malibu or sit in Aspen or sit on the beach, you know, in Outer Banks, do whatever that is? You know, let's get real. The number one thing that we have put to economic use in our region is natural resources, and it will continue to be natural resources. And can we then begin to develop natural resources that can be sustainable, regenerative, that continue to give people meaning and dignity, and that, you know, where we don't externalize all of this cost and people can get a living wage that is comparable to a coal income? And people aren't versed in what a coal income is. You know, people have in the media some idea, you know, my grandpappy's hard hat with a light, you know, people hard scrabble. Yeah, that happened all before the unions in the early 20th century. You know, once you had the unions come in and you had, you know, the wage shifted, you know, it's quite a highly skilled job now, quite technical, especially if you're doing surface mining. It's very technical. And that's like a $70,000 to $80,000 a year job. And so that's, you know, our target from the get-go has been, we don't really waste our time on sector consideration that couldn't eventually bring a family income to that. We don't necessarily expect that to be, you know, just one person. Yeah. And we're resource rich in McDowell County. We have the potential for maple product. We've been told, and this is one of the things we were really taking very seriously, we have some of the best potential for honey production in the best in West Virginia, us and Mingo County, in the region, because we don't have agricultural spraying. We have other contamination, but we don't have agricultural spraying, so it's excellent for bees. You know, there are a range of woodland products, so there are lots of other things there to develop, just that, you know, nobody until us really has been interested in pointing that out. And there's very little science being done on it because you have those, you know, myopic people at Virginia Tech, like I was crazy that there wasn't already a federal RFP. Well, you know, if we had the research universities in the region doing the research on this, we would have the science and technology to make the economic case for billion-dollar investments.
You know, you mentioned the word dignity and living wage. Have you heard of the concept subsidiarity?
I'm not familiar with that, actually.
Yeah, it's kind of powering down. In my own community, I tried to – it restores dignity to people that it's not all big brother, you know, that the community itself can come together and pool its resources, help one another, again, give a hand up, not a handout, And sure. It's a really important concept. It's not the same as solidarity, but, you know, it restores dignity to a person rather than feeling there's someone, you know, way out there somewhere that's going to come to my rescue. You know, they're a yeah. part also of, you know, being restored economically and being able to care for their family. But it's the community recognizing its natural resources as well as its people resources.
Sure.
To come together into one of those aid.
No, I would say that we are aligned with that. I mean, it's taken us a long time. You know, during my PhD, I heard someone say there's nothing more practical than a good theory. And so, you know, we never really articulated that we all feel a moral obligation. But, I think we've mm-hmm. come to that point where we're so down in the weeds about what needs to get done. But we've been able to take some time recently and reflect on how to articulate our bigger picture. And we've had some mentoring on that, some people from the outside who could say, well, you're actually doing this and this and this. And it's like, oh, yeah, that's great. Because, you know, when you're down in it, you can't necessarily see that, you know, the 10,000-foot view and how to describe that. And the term we've come up with recently, you know, along with 21st century economy is health equity economy. And that is, it sounds like gobbledygook, but what it really means is that it's about, you know, the health of people and the health of the space where they are and the place where they live. You want to live in a healthy
sure.
place, you know, and if you have healthy, you know, you have to have healthy people in order to have a healthy economy. If people are not healthy, mm-hmm. then you're not going to get much work out of them for anything and for each other.
Right.
You know, we just turn to each other then to begin to do this. Now, you know, we're not naive in that we, you know, don't anticipate having federal assistance. I mean, we've gotten some, you know,
right,
federal grants. And, you know, we feel like we're making the case for something that's much has potential to scale, right? So whatever
mm-hmm.
sector we've been, you know, taking on, that we're proving the model for its potential to scale. And, you know, it took Jedediah Hotchkiss 40 years. So there are a couple of us involved. James knows who's also a U.S. Army veteran. He's one of our co-founders of EDGE and one of the co-principals in it, you know, sort of leading the vision there on the ground in McDowell County around food production and mountain farming and mountain farming productions. And I've been kind of the institutional driver and theoretical person driving our institutional creation. Amelia Bandy, who's our executive director of cat herding along the way. But, you know, it's taken us 5 years, and, you know, we certainly expect to be doing it five, if not, you know, the rest of our lives. I had a chance in the early, mid-2000s to sit down, which I'm assuming was at midlife at about 38, or something, you know, 1,000 or whatever, you know, what I want to do next, and I want to be back in my region. And I wanted to do something, and I thought about, you know, like I said, starting a school, and I didn't know how one did that, and so I went back to get a PhD to figure something out. And so instead of starting a school per se, I've made good on that promise, you know, I'm doing something in McDowell. Certainly, you know, we have our trials and tribulations and so forth, but last but not least, I will say that while we each feel a moral obligation, you know, we don't step on each other's toes or get in each other's way, and that we haven't let political discussions or, you know, people's different
right.
takes on faith or people's different, you know, we found common ground and things to work on.
Sure.
And we've weathered some difficult steps along the way, but, you know, we are focused and, you know, keep on trucking. We are finally able to come up from air a little bit to see that what we're up to has larger implications beyond McDowell County, that if we can
right.
kind of pull this model together, then we have offer other places a model. You know, you do, like, you know,
yeah.
the father said that, you know, you do an assessment of what can you do locally and who could
sure.
do it. And, you know, and you, if people don't want to work with you, you find the people who do and keep on moving.
Well, you know,
right.
when you talk about government supplementing, we've said that also about veterans. There's certain things that veterans group do for veterans, but then the government needs to step in, especially
sure.
if it's a really important situation that, you know, is beyond the local community's ability to care for. But, you know, in a supplementary way, By all means. No, there's nothing naive about that.
Yeah,
they have a moral obligation, too. Yes, sir.
So, all right. Listening to this. All right. I want to applaud Crystal on the work she's done. I went and looked up. I saw some really good videos on YouTube. If anybody wants to look them up, I had to type in her name, Crystal Cook Marshall.
Yes.
Everybody keeps saying Crystal Cook, but you got to put.
Yeah,
there's
the
a lot
name.
Of Crystal Cook
out
there.
Marshall's tacked on the end.
Yeah, put the Marshall on there, and then put Edge, capital letters.
Yep.
But anyway. There's some videos, the farm projects you've been working on. And so when you've been talking, you've been speaking really in a lot of generalities, and I don't think people really have an appreciation for what you've actually been doing. You've been taking people backwards. Okay, now I'm going to say that from a historical perspective because that's my background.
I would call it a new agrarianism, and so I can talk a little bit about that.
All right. I love that.
I
love that. Okay. Now you got to understand that I grew up in Oklahoma.
Ah, I got you.
Well, I was born in Kansas, but I grew up in Oklahoma. And, all right, when Father Michael began the show, he talked about the poor. And when him and I talked about it, I asked him, I said, first you got to define what poor is.
Yeah.
Because what we consider being poor in this country is probably middle class and a lot of other, those of us who have worn the uniform have visited, okay?
But I will say the
if you're living in a cardboard
community there. It's a difference. And I've lived in Armenia. I've lived in places, you know, one of my favorite stories is of a close friend of mine who did sociological research in Russia, and one of the questions she asked people, she went out to the peasants, she asked this peasant family, so what's your favorite food? And they just stared at her. Our favorite food is food. What do you mean your favorite food is food? The food you can eat.
Right. Let me ask you, did they consider themselves poor?
You know, I would say that probably not, and I will say the difference. This is where, you know, James, I posted an article the other day about how we're not going to economically develop our way out of the opioid crisis, and he's mentioned the opioid crisis there in McDowell, and we have, you know, in West Virginia, we had the highest, so we had 100,000 opioid deaths in America in the last year, and I would consider that I've had at least, you know, I got off Facebook because I can't take the death every day anymore. Everybody, you know, I'm the age now, everybody's parents are dying. My mother was put on prescription opioids in her 70s in West Virginia for sciatica, and it led to her eventual demise. So she wasn't an addict. She took a low dose.
Right. I know.
But
what you're confirming is it's the doctors who are killing us. The opioid.
I mean, and the core group of us, every single one of us in the core group is touched personally in their families by opioid addiction, prescribed or otherwise. And
all right, but
the
back,
thing
let's
that was
get back
amazing
to
me about this article.
That's another topic.
That we could talk again for a long time about that. But the thing that got me about this article that I posted was that I didn't, you know, I'm lucky in that, you know, I've had a couple surgeries in my life, and, you know, I was aware at that point, like, give me the morphine once and take me immediately off of it. You know, my uncle that I mentioned, who was a miner, he was a medic in World War II, and that was his job, to go through the field and pick out who could live and die and give him a morphine shot. So I'm very aware of, you know, kind of what that
happened. All right, are we talking about opioid epidemic, or are we talking about getting back to our roots?
Well, we're talking about both, and here's the root that I want to say, is that the article
I'm going to agree with you. They are connected. You're right.
That the feeling, apparently, you get from opioids is a feeling of connectivity and love and that all was well in the world. You know, my mother grew up
and
very
the problem
much
is,
that one, a very
right,
difficult
and
thing.
The problem is you get that feeling the first couple times you use that drug, and then you need that drug to feel normal.
Well, back to the
that
father's
is all
point
transitory.
About community
okay.
is that we realize, and I would say that we're not fully developed on this yet, what we're doing in McDowell, but we're moving that direction, is that that we're not only economic development, but we're really community development. And we started our nonprofit because a couple of us went to a conference on Appalachia, and they were putting these dots up of places that were working on food issues and these institutions. And there wasn't one where we were. And we said, well, that's what we need. We need an anchor institution. And, you know, and what the organizing an anchor institution.
Wait. Like, explain that to me again. I heard an anchor institution.
An anchor institution. So here's what an anchor institution
explain
is.
What that is. That doesn't mean anything.
That's not what
me.
I want to explain to you. So for the history of coal in our region, for most of the history of coal, the anchor institution was the union. And I'm not talking about, like, you know, rallies and Mother Jones and that kind of stuff. I'm talking about the day-to-day organizing group for, you know, the miners was if you had an issue. So it wasn't an issue if you had an issue with your boss. It was if you had, you know, a fire, if you had a medical issue, you went to the union house and they organized the community around you to assist you. And once you didn't need people and the nature of mining changed, the nature of that relationship changed, and there was no anchor institution. Really from about the late 1980s and the early 90s forward, the union was very weak, and there are many reasons for that. And there's a host of research out there that shows, you know, particularly in Appalachia, that people began to feel kind of like they didn't have any bearings or any moorings, that the community trust tanked, people didn't trust anybody else. That they, you know, thought their, you know, maybe schools and churches and church kind of became a focal point. But then they consolidated all of our schools because we lost population. So people didn't have the union, and at least they felt like they had solidarity or connection or community based to their school. And so then that went away. You know, there's no local school anymore. And you know, our area where we work is just littered with empty schoolhouses. And people had no place to go to kind of organize themselves or to turn to if they, you know, needed help, you know, maybe beyond their church, and even that had a dwindling population in it. And so, you know, we are collective creatures. We are creatures of community. You know, it's not just enough to give us a job. We have to feel connected. I mean, I'm sure you're probably familiar with the book Bowling Alone. You know, it was written in the early 2000s, where since the mid 20th century, we belong to fewer clubs. You know, we don't. You know, it used to be everybody. You know, lots of folks belong to a Kiwanis club or a civic club, in addition to church and school and work and union and whatever else. You also belong to civic clubs.
All right, I can address that. See, I saw a study done where it talked. All right. If you go back through history, you're going to find that most villages were not really a lot more than 100 people.
Sure.
And what they found, the study did, is once populations grew, like in the cities, people had their connection. What you had is you had these small villages within these large communities, at least large cities.
Absolutely.
You know, so everybody had their if you counted up all their acquaintances, colleagues or whatever, you know, their village could be where they worked.
Right.
But it's still a nucleus of about 100 people. And it was interesting because I just throw this out because the nucleus of a Roman century is 100 people. The average nucleus of an army company, an infantry company, is around 100 men. Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, so you're going to find most of these villages were about that many people, and they supported each other. Everything you're describing, you're talking about the unions grew up over a product, coal.
Yeah.
Okay. Patient. Okay. But what I want to get back to, because what I'm seeing what you're doing is taking us back in history. Could be a good thing, could be a bad thing. That's for audience.
Well, I don't know if it's going back.
Well, let me follow, because you have a – look, once you get started, you have a lot to talk about. You're very impassioned, and I'll never get to describe this. Okay, so I'm just as bad as you. Anybody who's listening to me, I'm just as bad as you. I can hog the mic. So I'm going to try to summarize this real quick and then let you respond to it. Okay, so I'm a historian, and what I'm seeing is you're taking us back in history. There's a whole evolutionary process about when the first settlers came to this country, Virginia, Massachusetts, wherever. And when they came here, the first thing they had to do was farm. They had to feed themselves. That's the first thing. Then they found a product like tobacco, whatever, that they could make they could export and make a profit off. And that's what happened to West Virginia. They found coal when you talked about natural resources. Now, you go to Oklahoma, until they found oil, the only thing they had, people were moving to Oklahoma, migrating in there. See, I was still hearing stories about the homesteaders that came in there, okay? So I grew up, you know, Pachella and I have similar but dissimilar backgrounds. We talk about growing up poor. See, he grew up poor in the city. Yeah. I grew up poor in Oklahoma, and I did not consider myself poor. I knew everybody. I knew most people had a lot more than I did. My mother at one time had to work two jobs of food on the table. Yeah, when you describe that story, it's like, what's your favorite food? What do you mean? I'm happy to eat. I was skinny. But, you know, I never considered myself poor. And that's one of the things I want to point out. And again, after I got out of the Army and I moved back to Oklahoma, you know, I found out that the poverty line was at that time like $14,000 a year. And I was making below that. That qualified me as poor, but I did not consider myself poor because all my needs were met.
Yeah.
I had a house. Okay. I was providing for my family. I couldn't provide any extras, but I provided the need. And during that time I was growing up, because I heard the story of the homesteaders, they were happy to be able to eat.
Yes.
They were happy they were out of the work. And so that's why I asked, you know, Father Michael, when he described poverty, it's all relative. When you look at what we consider, we're poor because I don't have this or I don't have that. If your basic needs are met, you are not. You go to any other country in the world, all these places that Trump called shitholes, that until he gave that term, I called them cesspools and stuff like that. But yeah, I have visited shitholes. I know what real poverty is. Okay, and we have.
But when you faint
that
from
in
not
this country,
eating, you know you're poor. Okay, I told you I was serving mass like 6 years old, fainted from not eating during the mass. Then you know you're poor.
If you've got a roof over your head and you've got food you can eat, and that's why I never considered myself poor.
But my
that
question
was
would be
point.
In those communities that you observed abroad and in your own community, you know, what we see here in Appalachia is that people likewise help each other out. Now, despite all the tanking of the anchor institution, you know, I watched this with my mother. You know, my mother had a limited income for many years after my parents' divorce. And, you know, people are always making food for each other or arranging a ride or, you know, figuring it out then for each other. And probably, like you said, you know, somewhere between 40 to 50 to 100 people, you know, kind of circled around at the end of the day that was that size of a community. And, you know, I know probably I've seen this most closely in Armenia, where I spent quite a bit of time. People there didn't have much, but in the family and in the community, people would look out for each other. And that's the kind of connection that, you know, there's a debate out there whether you can artificially create that or not. And I don't really know what artificial means. I mean, you know, we create the economy, we can create community. So, you know, you have to give people a place to come to where they can find that dignity as the father.
You're describing early settlements where people had to depend on each other. And so what you're describing, see, today we evaluate ourselves by what we have, by our possessions, what we have and what we don't have. And I think, you know, we're not better off for it. So what you're describing, where a community is dependent on each other, you know, they lost coal. They have lost it. The big income is gone. Look, what I'm really trying to get to, I loved your video on Walmart closing down in the county. That's destroyed. When I listen
that was
to it, it sounds like it's destroyed the economy. I'm going, look, when I grew up, we didn't have in Oklahoma, Kansas, it was IGA. All right.
Sure.
I had to walk a couple blocks to the mom and pop grocery store to buy groceries, and we bought it on credit, and at the end of the month we paid it off. We bought all our food on credit, but it was like 3 or 4 blocks away. We walked there. Now what these IGAs, the Walmarts, did was they made it cheaper, because now you got to understand, it was one car family. When I grew up, the economy was a one car family.
Yeah.
So that car was used to drive to work and back, not to go shopping. We have 2-car families, 3-car. Everybody in the household has a car. In my car, I got a 2-car garage. We have 1 car parked outside. Okay. So what happens is you can drive 30 minutes Walmart or whatever to buy food. What happens when Walmart goes away? We go back to what we were before.
Sure.
And that's what you're trying to create. You're trying to create what we had in the beginning. So when I say let me follow on this. And then again, so when you're taking us back to rural America, where people ate the food they grew, where that food was brought to a central area that you could buy, they didn't have Walmarts back then.
No.
They had a marketplace. So you haven't described really what this edge is. You're teaching people in West Virginia how to farm again.
Yes.
You're trying to create a market. It's one thing is, like, we've had this conversation before. No one wants to buy a tomato that is blemished. They want to go to Walmart and get this tomato that looks perfect, okay, has the right color, that is artificial, because it's tomato that is artificially made red, all right? We've been programmed to expect that. What you're trying to do is reduce us back to how we started. Is that good or is that bad?
I would not say we're going backwards, because we're going forward with the
I'm saying we
the
are. Historically, we are. Now, I'm going to give you this credit, because, yes, we are moving forward. But in moving forward, when you have taken away from that economy that which they depended on for export, now we're talking about a gut oil. Until oil,
We're still talking export. We're not talking about it.
Hearing from you is feeding the economy. I haven't seen you produce. All right, I throw that out, because what you're doing is an economy is devastated, and you're trying to feed them. You're trying to get them self-sufficient on producing their own food.
No,
You're building a marketplace. You're asking for $50,000, Matt Fudd, to build this marketplace, what we used to call a farmer's market. Every town had one.
It's not a farmer's market, and it's not only in that scale. So let me answer a couple things very quickly.
Okay.
So we also are not naive in thinking that we're going to be able to switch people over to food that is only grown locally. There's a lot of issues then with that, and it's going to take time to build producers. In the meantime, you know, we are looking at things that can scale and make real money, because you have to be able to do that in order to sustain an economic sector. And so the things that I listed off before, the things that we've come up with, are not small scale. When we're developing a model where local people can afford them, But they're still export items because most natural resource areas, most rural areas.
All right.
All I read
on your site was farming. What's your export item?
So we are in the process of developing at the demonstration farm maple and tree syrups, honey, compost, and compost goes to three principal markets. It goes to, it sounds kind of odd, but golf courses, hemp production, and viticulture. We have a demonstration water capture, and then we also have high tunnels for fruit and vegetable production, and then there's also a sauce in process now for a large-scale sauce company out of Winston-Salem. And so we anticipate that a range of those things, once we are able to scale them, are going to be export products. However, simultaneously, we are looking to transplant the imported food that is brought into schools and brought into the grocery store there with food that is grown locally. And all of this happens at the same time. So it's not just a self-sufficient economy. That's, you know, even during the times of pioneers, you know, people were importing and exporting things.
Correct.
You know, your flour didn't come from where
correct,
you were.
Correct.
You know, there are things that, you know, it's just not practical.
That's what the general store did.
And we're doing this with the knowledge of what happens when you build, and this is actually, you know, part of a book that I'm under contract with. I have it forthcoming, and hopefully in 2022, if I can get everything across the finish line, with Lexington Press, where I discuss the concept of what I call big rural. So, you know, we know the idea of big banks or, you know, big industry, whatever
right.
it is, being too big to fail. So we kind of think of these big rural sectors as being too big to fail, but we know that they fail. And we know that they fail because of, and this is the thing that my respondents during my doctoral work said to me when I asked them what they could, you know, I asked them two things. If they could do, you know, one thing, what would they do? And people gave me their answers, you know, to fix their town. And I asked them what the biggest problem was, and I expected them to say poverty, and a lot of people say opioids, and this is well before the opioid crisis hit, you know, national discussion. But they said to me it was leadership, that the number one problem they had where they lived was lack of vision and leadership. And so the failing there, you know, and then not pointing things at particular people, but it's a political failing, right? And it's a moral failing.
Right, I'm going to challenge you on that
plans,
one. All right, once again, growing up in Oklahoma, all right. See, we didn't need leadership. When we were the pioneers that came out there and they were busting sod and living in sod houses because there's no trees to build log cabins, all right. They were focusing on survival and producing enough and then coming together as a community to support each other and to trade food. It was about subsistence farming. Then once they got established, then they started producing a cash crop, which in Oklahoma was wheat. Wheat and corn was northern Oklahoma. Okay, so then once you produce a cash crop, then you can provide a surplus because you need that for the general store. So now you can buy the luxuries that you need. I think that's where you're at in Bernard County, West Virginia?
It's Berwyn.
McDowell
County.
All right.
Yes and no. I mean, our whole region used to be speckled similarly with, until the 1920s, you had the same kind of mom-and-pop mountain, you know,
right.
Grocery stores throughout the region. I live near Statesville,
right.
North Carolina, the main aggregator for all of that. They aggregated herbs and wild herbs and product from all across the region. It was brought down to Statesville, North Carolina, with a major herb exporter, actually exporting at that time to China. And they you mentioned one of our region's finest things here at the beginning of the show, and I think that was James that mentioned it, moonshine. So the farmers also sold moonshine to the stores, and the stores aggregated that. Prohibition put an end to that, and the strained relationship with China.
No. Prohibition did not put an end to it. It just pushed it under.
They put an end to the aggregation. I mean, there are lots of people did it openly, and they did it as some a means to keep their farm open, whether they were drinking or not.
It's
the mortgage maker, like your hogs. Your hogs were the mortgage maker. So not dissimilar. And I'm not
the seal didn't close because of prohibition. All right, I'm just gonna throw this out as a joke, and this is a sexist joke. Okay, so all the men go off to fight in France in World War I, and they come back when they finally, we passed the amendment to allow women to vote. What do they do? They outlaw alcohol.
Temperance. Yeah. Right. Well, certainly wasn't working class women doing for temperance. Yeah, women probably also were tired of getting the hell
knocked
out. I'm just joking.
I mean, so let's move on. Let's move on to
my grandfather certainly, as a constable in Bland County, Virginia, did his share of drinking and whacking up on my petite grandmother. So I can appreciate that she might have.
I just want to point out, historically, the only amendment that has ever been passed that has been repealed is prohibition.
Yes,
that's how
we get
stupid
it
was.
Yes, I'm with you, but we're not looking to go backward. And so we're not looking to go backward. We see this as part of the 21st century economy where you create the economy on purpose. You use the local resources that are there. You bring people together in community, and you create institutions where the government and private industry haven't done it yet. And ideally, folks will eventually follow along. So we are the advocates. And so we see it as a very 21st century movement. My mother grew up the youngest of 10 in a sharecropping family. And, nobody's advocating for anybody to go back to being a, sustainable mountain farm in that model. It's just not practical.
I'm going to challenge you on that. I agree with you. I'm going to agree with you because there's a question I had is, why did you get a PhD to do something that is entrepreneurial that anyone who had a good mind could have done, right? But you're bringing a scientific approach to it. So I want to table that for later. But when I looked, just go online, everybody, because what she's doing, Crystal Cook Marshall, because there's a lot of Crystal Cooks on there. You have to add the Marshall and add Edge. And if you type it, you're going to see the work she's doing. There's videos on it which show what she's doing. Well, I'm going, you're returning us to our roots. You're returning us to the honey and stuff. Yes, if you can produce more than you consume, you have a surplus that you can trade with other communities. But you're returning us to the 19th century. But I'm going to admit what you described is, but you're applying a scientific approach to it, which would be a 21st century approach.
Well, it would actually
disagree?
It would be a mid-19th century approach with the development of the agricultural land grant universities like Virginia Tech, WVU, et cetera. That's where they started to do the scientization of farming, and that's why we lost our small sustainable farms here in the Mountain South, is because after World War II, they started advocating for large corporate mega farms, and the science and research went that direction in the Midwest and West, and it killed. So the reason we're poor, so let's get back to McDowell County. So the reason in West Virginia, the reason we're poor is not only because of automation, but in the 1950s, when the rest of the country began to kind of take off economically, there were a lot of small farms and a lot of people still doing side farming throughout Appalachia. And what happened at that time was a tremendous amount of lobbying towards creating mega farms in the Midwest and West and shifting where our food was produced, right, to the Midwest and West to take them to these IGAs and eventually what would, become Walmart, where most of our food only comes from a couple places. Most of the food we get in the United States comes from two places. That's California and Iowa. Florida is a distant
third. No, actually Arizona. Arizona has, that's where a lot of your lettuce and tomatoes and stuff comes from.
Fine, but that's not the bulk of your calories. The bulk of your calories are coming from, you know, meat and meat products, and that's aggregated then through Iowa and the rest
of
California.
Well, I'm
going to
tell you, we eat bread,
third
and so,
is,
so
third is
corn. And corn. Oh, now I'm going
to
tell you,
fed to animals.
Corn and soybeans, because that's where I come from, Oklahoma and Kansas.
Yeah, fed to animals.
But
people,
a lot of that is exported. Has been exported overseas. China was the biggest consumer of our soybeans.
Sure, in America, where
until,
you're getting
until
most
Trump.
Of your food, you know, it's on about three highways. It's coming from California or Iowa, and then the next part of it is imported. So you're the bulk of your calories comes from those. Actually, in the reverse order, Iowa, California, then imported. So, there's a, you know, a long reason to also have, for national security reasons, to have more food grown, you know, dispersed across the United States. And we had that until the 1950s. And the small farmers, who folks who farmed on the side, couldn't compete. And
absolutely,
they lost their farm
absolutely.
In the 1950s.
Absolutely,
so, this
absolutely.
Was, you know, 50
Look,
acres
I watched
left.
That. You're describing what I observe. The small farmer, I'm friends with a small farmer. He still owns his bottom, and he bought it from a land run, you know, from where I come, in what was the Cherokee Strip. The land run was in 1893, and if you own land there, it's like there are, I don't know anyone who's an original land run family, but the friend of mine who owns bottom land, he bought his property from a land run. It's like one out of four people that made that land run was going to succeed. The one that made it was going to buy everybody else's farms.
Yeah, I mean, for
and
you,
so
a small farm
he
in Oklahoma is a couple thousand acres. You know, for us in Appalachia, it was about 50 acres. And you know, and so that's,
yeah,
so that's
it's not a thousand. No, the big farms were 1,000. No, my friend was he really qualifies in the small farm. But my okay. point is that you're just, I mean, you're what you're describing. We're really saying the same thing. We just don't agree on it. But when we look at evolution of economies or cultures. It begins with subsistence farming, the ability to feed your community.
Sure.
Right? Then when you can produce a surplus, which you are working on, and that's admirable. Working on, you're like honey. I saw that you got these honey, but you're showing like and chicken, poultry, and all this stuff. There's a lot of things you could describe that. But you're like shooting, I mean, you're like, I'm not going to say, it's not fair to shoot in the dark. You're really like, you know, you're exploring a whole lot of opportunities. Any one of these could be enough to be a surplus, to bring outside cash into our community. So
yes.
The first, when the evolution of our economy is subsistence farming, surplus product, and then all of a sudden you find a natural resource that you can exploit. And when you lose that, a natural resource, I loved what you were talking about in the beginning where they talk about, what do you say, the twilight or the end, where, okay, so when this runs out, what's your plan?
Sunset,
okay,
yeah.
Well, everybody moves. Sunset, I love that. Well, we never had that. That's why we have all these ghost towns throughout America,
right.
Okay? And we have you probably have ghost towns in West Virginia.
Oh, certainly.
We have ghost towns in Oklahoma. I love visiting ghost towns.
There's ghost towns
but
everywhere.
The thing is, yeah. But the thing is, it's about, you know, when you have you go from that village of 100 people. I grew up in small towns, but it's the larger towns that has the better schools. We talked our mother into marrying, you know, her boyfriend, so we could move to the town that had a population of over 1,000 that had better schools. That way I could qualify for West Point. I couldn't have gone to West Point from the town I was growing up. There's a really small town. So there is a definite benefit of having a surplus. But you know what that town I moved into? It was an oil town. Conoco, it was the headquarters for Continental Oil Company. So we were relying on a natural resource. You're, what you've done, what I've looked
James,
at, what you've done is you're looking at a, your natural resource is drying up, and you're trying to rebuild it by taking us back to where we were, but you're using a scientific approach to it.
So there's plenty of coal being mined, but I do want to take us back to the concept of the working poor. And so I want to turn the conversation back to James and other folks. There's plenty of coal being mined. They just don't need people. And so there are other resources that can be utilized. So, you know, we have a conversation about moral obligation and working poor. So
that
we can,
yeah, that's why I wanted to bring up the concept of the common good, because we're talking about community. I just want to read quickly, and this is just talking about people who are just, you know, accumulating, and they're not really understanding a sense of the common good and community. It says, owners who heedlessly idolize their goods, and there are a lot of different scriptures here, become owned and enslaved by them. Mm. And I think when we don't understand the concept of the common good, and I'm not talking about communism or socialism, as I mentioned earlier in scripture, was voluntary, but the sense of community where we're not codependent, but we're not independent, but we're interdependent. That's what makes a true community.
And we are anyway, right? I mean, we're interdependent, and there are many factors. And so the thing that I learned back to the very beginning of the conversation is if we want to really do economic sector intervention, it takes lots of stakeholders on many fronts. It takes science and research backing it. It takes tremendous amount of capital. And if that's not readily available to you in your community, you know, not that, you know, I'm certainly not advocating for anybody to bootstrap it. I mean, all of us who are involved have other work or other things that we do to support ourselves, to keep this going and keeping, you know, keep ourselves going. But to look around and think, you know, am I resourceless? You know, and you don't have to start with everything. I mean, we kind of have an interesting approach and that we started on many fronts. You know, we identified quite a few things and we're moving, many, many moving parts at the same time. But you don't have to do it that way. I mean, you know, you can start with, is it just community? Is it more connection? Can I build more connection where I am? Maybe that's the thing that I need. And, you know, when James mentioned that the show would be about the working poor, I started kind of wringing my hands thinking like, well, you know, what, you know, I don't quite know what you do about the, on a large scale about the working poor. I mean, I know what we're attempting to do where we are is to shift the economy to where, you know, there are a few coal jobs left, but there aren't, those are few and far between. The people who remain in McDowell County, you know, they're the, when the state itself becomes your main employer, then you know you're one of the poorest counties around. So there, you know, right. Walmart had been the other major employer, and so the Walmart hit would have been difficult, but that's a retail position, and it's not well paid. And although we've been, there's been a lot of tourism there, surprisingly, there's a robust ATV trail, set of tourism opportunities there. There are ATV trails and people come from all over the country. When we get people from Canada, Michigan, you name it, coming down to ride ATVs and on these trails in McDowell County, and they're also in Virginia and in Mercer County there. If you don't own a business that caters to them, so if you don't have enough capital then to open a restaurant or a bed and breakfast or a campground or something like that that caters to this group, then you might work for one of those, and that's low wage. We're back to the conversation
you
around the working poor.
You mentioned earlier, Crystal, about a living wage, and I think that there's a lot of corporations and companies that exploit people, and I'm not suggesting $15 an hour for flipping burgers, okay?
Yeah, I get you.
But I, you know what I'm saying? I do think we have to restore some kind of a dignity, especially in some of these jobs where you see the CEOs get millions and millions of dollars even when they fail the company, and there's no stockholders. There's no sense.
Right. Well,
I mean,
it's about
responsibility,
my mother
worked in McDonald's in her 80s, and she kept telling us she was buying stock. When she died, she left us $10,000. 5 years later, somebody contacted us. She had another $10,000. And there's got to be, you know, my, and like I said, my mother was in her 80s, poor, working at McDonald's as like a shift manager. And I'm saying there's got to be some more incentive. There's got to be some more incentive so that people can share in the productivity rather than just exploiting people and then throwing them away.
I don't know how you dictate morality. I don't know whether, I don't know how that happens.
Well,
we
have laws against murder and rape. We have laws against murder and rape. That's legislating morality.
Yeah,
why
no, I'm
can't,
with you.
Why,
no, no, fair enough. I guess the issue becomes that, if we do go back to something, right? I don't think we're going back to the 1960s. So let's go back to the 1960s. Or, when you had a tax rate that was different,
yeah.
and a distribution that was different. Now, it didn't always get distributed. I mean, McDowell County, West Virginia, remains one of the examples where it didn't matter who was in power. The money didn't trickle down there into, infrastructure or whatever. So you have to have people who have a moral core to feel that it's not only, that whatever it is doesn't only have to lie in their pocket, that they have some... what we're up to
has to be just.
It would be just, right? So what we're up to was tried already. There were leagues of people who came down, on the tail of Kennedy's visit to West Virginia in the 1960s. There was a whole movement that was created around the VISTA program, and I'm sure you're familiar with those folks. So people came down. I know two people personally who are now in their 80s. That in the 1960s, one of them worked in Clay County, West Virginia, and the other gentleman I've met, he wrote a book called They'll Cut Off Your Project. He was in Mingo County, West Virginia, doing very similar work to us in the 1960s. And they started to get federal funding, and the local politicians didn't like it. And they literally came along and they explained to the feds, you can't give this money directly to these poor people anymore to do this programming or to do this development. It needs to come through us. And as soon as it began to come through them, they cut off the projects. Right?
Of course.
This was in the 1960s. So I think the difference now is, we have that knowledge of what happened to them then. People are maybe a little more careful, and the internet can be a good thing or a bad thing. But people can share information and report and do citizen reporting and that kind of stuff to where that might not happen quite that way again. I don't know how you get people to have a moral core to I'll be very frank. In Southern West Virginia, there's very stratified. It was very stratified when I was a child. There's a kind of there are people who have been in systemic poverty. So it's not just, people think of coal miners as poor. Miners aren't really poor. I mean, it's the folks, they're class of folks below miners. And, James, having traveled around in West Virginia, might have seen that. There's a group of folks that, people really kind of shun. And I heard it out of people's mouths, and complained.
I think a just wage, Crystal, is something that has to be negotiated. That's why the early unions, even though they were conceived in some violence, a just wage to be able to negotiate and not to exploit people and to say these hardworking working poor can't be entrusted as stewards with the hard-earned money that they are working for. That's unjust.
I agree with you, and that's part of what we've tried to focus on, and back to the specifics. We've had on the ground pilots the entire 5 years. We tried to think, what else could we do here? My family here in North Carolina might, it's a modest bird, but we have an on the ground pilot of meat goats, which might seem kind of odd, but the environment in Southern West Virginia is great for meat goat production, and it's the highest command price per pound meat after lamb in the country, and it's the most demand meat in the world. So we've explored that, we've explored these other things for scale, and we sort of settled on a group of them for the demonstration farm in McDowell, and we're looking to scale all of those. We've gotten some money coming in from the state. We are waiting on some information on some federal granting to begin to scale some of this, and we see it as a 40-year project. And if we can do it there, maybe we'll be a model for someplace else then to do it. And, you know, I will say this, you know, if people want to kind of understand the working poor, I recently, it might sound like this is a far off aside, but I found out that I have something called hemochromatosis, which is iron overload. And that makes me a great candidate to give blood and donate platelets and also donate plasma. And I've been doing those things. And if you want to get to know some working poor, go stand in a plasma donation line. You know, I do it now and again, and I just happened to go through it this morning. I'm standing in Hickory, North Carolina, and there are two women behind me. One of them is my age, and she cleans hotel rooms, and she's telling me about her jobs in the furniture factories and her child and her his girlfriend who work in the Jersey Mike's, and the woman behind her has worked all kinds of, you know, lower wage jobs her whole life. Her son has gone on to become a mechanical engineer, but she's now, you know, she's worked at Walmart and did her, you know, best she could the year she worked at Walmart until, you know, a customer abused her so bad one day. She's like, I just can't do this anymore. And, you know, there's a whole line of people. Another woman standing there behind me, she works a 12-hour shift, but she's come in. You know, if you're a new customer, you get paid $100 to donate your plasma. But if you've done it before, you get $30. And so there are people who are coming in, waiting in line 2 or 3 hours to make an extra $30. As the one woman said to me today, you know, that's gas.
Walking to work.
The other one said to me, well, you know, the older lady said, well, you know, it's going to be modest. The one with the mechanical engineer son is going to be small Christmas gifts this year.
Wow.
And I, you know, and the other woman, you know, behind me, just, you know, was fretting, you know, standing up and just, you know, she's working the third shift now. It's been years since she worked the third shift. How many of us have worked the third shift? Work third shift. And, you know, if you could come stand in that line now and again, you want to meet some working poor people, go stand in the plasma line. You want to pay you. Not all states will let you get paid, but, you know, they're in North Carolina. And so I'm thinking, you know, I don't know what to do, but what I was saying to people, I keep hearing a lot of people who say, well, everybody wants to work. That's why there are all these jobs open right now. And I'm talking to the folks in the line, I'm like, well, you know, do you really want to work retail? Have you worked retail before? Have you worked food service? Have you worked fast food service? I mean, if you can go do something else, then you would. And back to the point of community, you know, the thing that I know about a lot of those jobs is you don't get regular hours. You know, they work you, there's some kind of weird, you know, just policy-wise, like some kind of weird thing where they started it a while back. It used to be, you know, if you worked in the grocery store, you knew your hours were from this time to that time and whatever. Or you worked retail, you worked from this time to that time, or you could fill it in as a part-time job, but they won't let you have steady hours anymore. It's very difficult to plan the rest of your life. It's very difficult to get involved civically or, you know, volunteer at your kids. You know, you don't have money to volunteer to coach your kids' sports team or to go to their games or to do whatever. But the way that work has become structured is that it's almost on purpose. You know, I don't know the theory, but you all might know it. But there's even a theory out there, maybe a corporate theory, that you destabilize people so they can't go.
All right, all right.
Work.
We're getting close to the end of the show. Can I interject something?
Yeah, we got 2 minutes. Yeah, go ahead, Rich.
All right, because I want 1 minute. All right.
Gotcha.
Crystal, all right. Tell people, because you need support, tell people where they can go to on the internet to find out what you're doing.
Sure, we're in process of updating our website, so there are a few things that don't work like they should, but we're at edge-us.org, and we're working on a community grocery to supplement the Walmart that's there. We're working on pilot projects, and we'd love to have folks get involved and support what we're doing.
Great.
Go ahead, Rich.
All right. Actually, all you need to do is type in what I did was Crystal Cook Marshall Edge, and you'll find a lot of stuff for what she does. Okay, guys, here it is. This is very selfish of me. Go Army, beat Navy. Go Army, beat Navy.
That's right.
The
I win either way.
ESP.
You know that, Rich. I
beat
win
Navy
either way.
Again. Okay. James and Michael did not tell what I was going to say at the end of the show. Tomorrow is the Army-Navy game. Right. Yeah. Or RBB day, you know what I'm going to be doing after 3 o'clock.
All right, folks. Listen, it's been a great show. We got 10 seconds. Crystal, thanks for coming on here. Father Michael,
thank you so much for
Rich,
having
God bless you. We'll have you back on. Thank you for listening.
Nice meeting you.
Continue,
we'll talk to you. Nice to meet y'all. Y'all have a great night.
Good night.
I know. Blessing.